Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this issue, we focus on triple-negative breast cancer. And to begin, I met with Dr. Hope Rugo, and she started our conversation by discussing the biology of this subset of the disease. I just want to begin with sort of an academic question. We're focusing on triple-negative disease. And I guess my question to you today is, at this point, with a lot more sort of translational biologic knowledge about this disease, how you view triple-negative breast cancer? Do you even view it as the third disease? And is it just the absence of ER and HER2, or is there something in your mind that characterizes the biology of triple-negative breast cancer?
You know, I think what we've realized, it's kind of funny. I always used to think of triple-negative breast cancer as non-A, non-B hepatitis, you know, from training, where you really characterize something by the absence of things that we use for treatment. And having been practicing since the discovery of HER2 and then development of targeting HER2, it's been an interesting transition to, you know, understand as we had treatment for HER2 that there was a separate group where people had very aggressive disease and often fared very poorly. But I think since that time, which now is two decades old, we have, you know, really in clinical practice, what you recognize is that this is a very heterogeneous disease. And in some ways, we haven't exactly figured out how to change that heterogeneity for the entire group of patients. So, you know, how to address that heterogeneity, more aptly put. So you have patients, the majority of patients who have, you know, very proliferative, high-grade, triple-negative disease. Some have a little percent of ER, but they still act very much like triple-negative disease, you know, maybe 2% or less than 10%. You know, hard to know where that transition is. And then some people have the ER of zero, very aggressive, rapidly growing disease. And then still others, a smaller subset, have these kind of indolent triple-negative disease that almost looks like it's hormone receptor positive, but it has no receptors. So when, you know, you see a patient who has triple negative breast cancer, first you have to categorize in your mind, where does this cancer fit? Obviously, our approach to early stage and metastatic disease is going to be different as well, because in early stage disease, if you fall into the majority group where you have a more rapidly growing hormone receptor negative disease, HER2 negative, falls into the triple negative category or close enough, the next differential for us really is, how do you respond to chemotherapy? How does the cancer respond to chemotherapy? Because if you see a rapid shrinkage of the cancer, that falls into a category of very chemotherapy responsive disease. And then some of the patients have sort of a sluggish response, and then the cancer starts growing back again. That's our worst category of triple negative breast cancer. So it's really, in some ways, you're using the clinical differentiation and then response to therapy in the early stage neoadjuvant setting to try and differentiate out different subgroups biologically. Now, how that translates into our expression groups, you know, the gene expression groupings that have been created with intrinsic subtyping or with further differentiation in the sort of Peat and Pohl classification of triple negative disease, it's not entirely clear, because we don't use those gene expression subgroups in clinical practice. I'm guessing that there's some overlap, that it's not all, for example, if you look at a basal-like triple negative breast cancer, some of those cancers do very well, and then there's a subgroup that don't do very well, and we don't really understand why some of those groups are genetically plastic and mutate as you're treating them and become more and more resistant. And that's a huge challenge for us in the treatment of triple negative disease.
You know, it's interesting that you make that comment, because, you know, you're really talking about a lot of clinical observations as opposed to genomic profiles. You've been doing the I-SPY trials, you've been looking at people's tumors, and yet this is kind of what it kind of comes down to. Let me ask you kind of another related question, which is, because you referred several times to the idea of triple negative disease being aggressive. So let me ask you, for these numbers, I'm just kind of curious what you would say if one of your fellows said, in general, if you break it down again into these three subsets, ER positive, HER2 positive, and triple negative, with our current therapies, and you look at survival from diagnosis of metastatic disease, and of course, yeah, there's all the variables, but just in general, How much difference is there? What number would you give? What's the global median survival of a patient with metastatic triple negative, HER2 positive, ER positive with our current therapies?
Well, I think that, you know, we have recent data that gives us an idea about the median survival for triple negative disease in the metastatic first line setting from IMpassion 130. You know, in that trial, we enrolled patients who were at least a year from their adjuvant or neoadjuvant taxane chemotherapy. And that actually differentiates a group of patients who are going to have relatively better outcome than the patients who are just progressing and developing metastatic disease within, you know, weeks or months from their early stage diagnosis. So, you know, we're already looking at a group that's a little bit better. And the median survival was about 18 months, regardless of whether you had PD-L1 expression or not in the tumor immune cells. So it does go along with what I think we see in clinical practice. Sometimes we see a more chemotherapy responsive disease and the median survival is a little bit longer. Sometimes we see very resistant disease with rapid progression to brain or other critical organs with organ dysfunction, and those patients live appreciably less than 18 months. In contrast, in hormone receptor positive disease, the median survival for most patients, again, depending on the clinical factors like disease-free interval and how a patient presents, the median survival is more like 5 years. You know, I say that keeping in mind the fact that I have patients who I've been treating for much longer than 5 years and patients who die within 2 years of diagnosis of metastatic disease. So medians are really just that. You know, if you present with diffuse visceral disease with hormone receptor positive breast cancer, even if you're 8 or 10 years out, your prognosis is going to be much worse than a patient who presents with bone-only disease. And of course, if you present within a year of your initial diagnosis, you're going to have more hormone-resistant disease. For HER2-positive breast cancer, it's interesting. If you have de novo HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, a subset of those patients will be long-term survivors. We saw that in the recent update of the CLEOPATRA trial, where there's now 8-year follow-up of patients that was presented at ASCO. And you know, it's interesting, if you look at the patients who are progression-free, you know, there's a subset of patients who at 8 years have never progressed after first-line therapy with a taxane, pertuzumab, and trastuzumab. And so I think that we know there's that subgroup. They have HER2-enriched disease. We don't totally understand why there is that particular subgroup, and it's not everyone. If you had great HER2-targeted therapy in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting, and you develop metastatic breast cancer, your median survival is going to be shorter. Even with our novel agents, those patients are going to have a median survival in the, you know, 2 to 3 year range. You still have more treatment options than triple negative breast cancer even today. So the median survival is going to be a little bit longer, but it's shorter in general than patients with hormone receptor positive disease. There are variations in HER2 positive breast cancer based on ER.
Yeah, but let me just sort of pin you down a little bit, because that number that you just gave, I think, is pretty interesting. 18 months, 5 years, big difference. So roughly, globally, all comers, what are you looking at in terms of median survival with metastatic HER2-positive disease?
Again, I think there's a huge range for HER2-positive breast cancer, and it's so dependent on where you come from, de novo, prior treatment, disease-free interval. The median survivals can be as short as 18 months and as long as 10 plus years, depending on the subset of patients you come from. So probably the median for HER2-positive disease is in the 3 to 4 year range if you take that sort of very resistant HER2-positive disease and mix it with the exquisitely sensitive patients.
So certainly the experience as an oncologist taking care of patients with breast cancer is very different for a woman with metastatic triple negative and for localized triple negative. And I want to kind of spend most of our time today getting into kind of how it works in your own practice, and particularly how you integrate the individual preferences and issues with each patient that you see in crafting a decision with them. So we asked you to come up with a patient with localized disease so we could get into the issue of triple negative disease. And of course, as we guessed, you pulled somebody who was involved with I-SPY, because almost all your patients are involved with I-SPY. It's great because I want to see what's going on with I-SPY. But anyhow, what happened with this 33-year-old physician?
So this is actually a physician who is in post-residency training who presented actually kind of overnight with a big mass in her left breast. And she, you know, she lived a busy life, you know, working many long hours and with a long call. And so she noticed a sort of swelling in her breast, and that rapidly became quite large. painful and distorted the appearance of her breast with some nipple inversion. And so she came in for evaluation and was found on imaging to have a big mass. It's interesting, you know, these very young women, often the tumors are not well seen on any kind of mammography, standard mammography. And, you know, having just seen a woman who was in some other local places where she was referred, and people kept saying, oh, you're too young, it's a fibroadenoma. And I think, you know, that's a really dangerous thing. And it doesn't hit us as oncologists, but we see those patients. And it's just so important for that education to hit people in practice that even though it's uncommon, we do see breast cancers in young women. So, you know, she came and had this ultrasound that showed a, you know, a tumor that was a little under 2 centimeters, although on exam, the tumor was much larger. And on exam, we could also find an axillary node. A core biopsy showed a triple negative breast cancer with a Ki-67 of 70%. And although we could feel the node, we actually did fine needle aspiration several times of her axillary nodes, and they were benign. So that was kind of encouraging. We did an MRI then, which we do in young women with these dense breasts where you really can't see things well on the mammogram. And she had actually, which we see a lot in these triple negative cancers, central hypodensity, which was consistent with central necrosis of this large mass. And overall, the total size of the mass was just a little under 4 centimeters, so 3.8 centimeters. Another thing we see in these young women where the ultrasound really often undersizes the tumor. The tumor is actually quite a bit larger on MRI. Although again, MRI is very sensitive and not as specific, so you have to be cautious in what you recommend for surgery in those women.
Could I just ask, I'm just kind of curious what the MRI showed of the nodes that were negative on FNA.
Right. She has these prominent axillary nodes. One of the problems we always get into as oncologists is we see people after they've been poked a lot. So we have to be a little cautious. And we have to be cautious in our exams, too. You know, you don't want to recommend a mastectomy for a young woman without germline mutations based on something that's not really the extent of her tumor, particularly if you could shrink it with initial therapy, because this is a lifelong issue for these women who may be cured of their disease. So she actually had an MRI that was done after she'd had a core biopsy of her breast and fine needle aspirations of her axillary nodes twice. So it did show some prominence of the axillary nodes. And sometimes, you know, I've seen this in some of the young women where we get discordance. You know, we find nodes that feel like they should have cancer. They look a little funny on MRI and ultrasound, but we do the needle aspirations and they don't have cancer in them. Obviously, we sample at the time of surgery. And for a big triple negative cancer, having a positive node or not is not going to alter our treatment preoperatively. And I think the key thing is that most of these women do not need extensive axillary node sampling. So if you do a sentinel node and, you know, any enlarged nodes right around it, and those are negative, you can feel pretty confident. You know, these women also, they present with big cancers, they're young, they're all going to need radiation. You know, we don't need to do big axillary dissections in these women, even though we're not 100% sure whether or not originally their node had cancer in it.
So this is a shocking situation for anybody, particularly and including somebody in the medical profession. But I see, I guess you all took a little bit of a breath and thought about the issue of fertility.
Yeah, we thought about two big issues, and I think that's really important. You know, you diagnose these cancers, you want to take one step back and say, what are the two key issues? One is that you want to start thinking about germline genomic testing early. This is a patient who clearly fits into all the guidelines for germline genomic testing. Although she didn't have a family history, we know that a certain percentage of these young women, not a small percentage, might have a germline mutation. So that's something you have to talk to the patient about and send off early because we know it's going to impact her decisions about surgery in terms of a bilateral mastectomy or a lumpectomy unilateral. The second thing you have to think about right away is fertility issues because the chemotherapy that we give in the neoadjuvant setting may cause ovarian suppression that's more long duration. So we know it causes temporary ovarian suppression, but we don't know is what chemotherapy does for ovarian reserve. Most young women, depending on the chemo you give, will recover their ovarian function. But the problem is that we don't know what it does for their ovarian reserve. It's a huge issue for ER-positive cancer. We have to give hormone therapy afterwards. But for triple-negative disease in a 33-year-old woman, we already know that your ovarian reserve is starting to decline, sadly. So you want to not close any of those doors. This woman's single. She definitely had not closed the door on having children someday. And you always have the time to harvest eggs. I would say that, you know, it takes 2 weeks to harvest eggs. And now there's huge success with using frozen mature oocytes. So it's really, really important to give this option to our patients.
So I'm just kind of curious about the logistics of how you make this happen.
Yeah.
You've got this woman who's got this big triple negative tumor and these kind of concerning nodes. I'm sure you want to get therapy started right away. You say 2 weeks. So it sounds like the day they come to clinic, you get them started?
So the day they come to clinic, we call the, we actually have an inside line, and you just have to have that set up. People who are working in the fertility field are very much oriented towards this approach. They understand the timing, and, you know, you just do not want to ever close the door on a woman for fertility issues. I've seen that happen where somebody said, you know, you have to start treatment, we don't have time to harvest eggs, and then that door is closed forever. And it's really a tragic because, you know, it's not the case. We've never, ever shown that 2 weeks or even 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks makes a difference in the timing to start therapy. So what we do is we send a message to our fertility group. They get the patient in right away, and they're able to start medications right away. We actually have also the communications to foundations like the Livestrong Foundation that will provide some additional financial support to help women who don't have the money for the, or their insurance doesn't cover the medications you need. And if you start right away, you can actually harvest the eggs within 2 weeks, and you can start treatment the same day you harvest eggs if you really feel pushed. I usually try and wait a couple days in case they get, you know, a little bit of bloating and ascites. If they're very young, they can get a little bit of that with the harvest.
So I'm thinking about the word quality. We once did a day-long symposium on just quality, and I really wonder how many women in the United States right now are getting, you know, this procedure done in the first 2 weeks, that kind of setup, which seems like it really ought to be standard. The other thing about fertility that we've heard about, and I'm curious whether you do this strategy, is using an LHRH agonist. So to suppress the ovaries, obviously not related to the tumor, that is a strategy. It's been described. What do you think about it? Do you use it? Did you offer it to this lady?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's data. It's funny because I really have four things that I make sure I've covered, you know, so the germline testing, which often has been done before I see a patient, fertility in terms of egg harvesting, the use of GnRH agonists, and then scalp cooling for hair loss. So the GnRH agonists, you know, it's an interesting area. I think it makes theoretic sense to us that if you shut down the activity of the ovaries, that you might reduce the amount of toxicity from chemotherapy in some ways, similar to what we do with scalp cooling, where you actually use something that, you know, may reduce metabolism. I know that some fertility experts don't believe that, but others very strongly believe in it. We have the POEM study. But the problem with all these studies is no matter what you do, and that was really a Herculean effort, is that you always have smaller numbers than you intended, which was true of POEMs. And then, you know, people relapse with cancer, they decide not to get pregnant, they have other issues with their partner, you know, so you can't just like randomize to having babies or not, you know. So there is some data that suggests it doesn't do anything and other data that suggests that if you give the GnRH agonist, you can help preserve ovarian function. The downside of using these drugs, they're generally approved by insurance. So in the U.S., it's not a financial issue for our patients. The downside is that, you know, you do have the immediate menopause to deal with, along with the psychological trauma of breast cancer starting chemotherapy, whereas the ovarian suppression that occurs from chemotherapy is slower, and it's a little bit easier to adjust to. So when I tell women that we're going to, you know, this is an option for treatment, and I have to say everybody who's young says they want to use GnRH agonists with very few exceptions, I do tell them that the side effects, the menopause side effects, are going to be a little stronger than if they didn't use the GnRH agonist. But I do use them routinely. So that's another thing we put in for authorization.
It's amazing when you think about it, what, you know, happens, what transpires between the oncology team and a young patient like this with triple negative disease, you know, trying to cope with the cancer and at the same time having the courage to say, I'm thinking maybe I'll be okay. Let's, you know, see if I can do something about fertility. What a amazing situation to see people go through. How does she do with all this?
Well, and at the same time, I have to say that at the same time, for a young woman who's working, you know, they're worried about work. Are they going to keep their job? Are they going to be relevant? Are they going to get, somebody's going to get rid of them because they're not there? If they know they have cancer, do they think they won't be there in 2 years? So they're not going to, you know, people worry about that. They also worry about the appearance of, again, not having hair. That's one issue. And then another issue which comes up with young women because of reading on the internet is they worry about maybe they're going to have so-called chemo brain and they won't be able to think as well or do their job as well. And I've really reassured women about that a lot of it is the pre-medications and rescue medications for nausea. And with our current chemotherapy treatments for young women, we really don't see appreciable chemotherapy brain, so to speak, that's long-lasting. You know, I think anytime you're not sleeping well, you're taking lorazepam and feeling nauseated or, you know, coming in all the time and worrying, not sleeping well because of hot flashes, you're going to have some word-finding difficulties and things like that, but this isn't a long-lasting issue. The other thing just to mention about adjustment is that if you have access to psychology or some kind of supportive mechanism, it's really helpful. You know, I find support groups aren't so useful if they're all cancer because you have, you know, people in all stages and all ages, but there are some blogs online of young women's groups with breast cancer, and we have a local group here that's been incredibly supportive and helpful for women. And I think it's really worthwhile to refer these young women for some of those supportive groups because it can be tremendously helpful at a time when psychologically they're feeling so vulnerable.
So how did this woman do? I guess she ended up on the I-SPY trial. What was the randomization that she sort of encountered?
So our I-SPY program, you know, we talk to women about neoadjuvant therapy, and in this case, what I feel is the really incredible importance of giving neoadjuvant therapy in order to try and understand the response to therapy and then modify treatment to try and improve outcome based on response to therapy, either in the post-neoadjuvant setting where we have CREATE-X with capecitabine, or even before surgery where we do try and modify treatment based on response and are learning more and more about that. So we talked about I-SPY, which is an adaptively randomized phase 2 trial where we compare a standard chemotherapy backbone to novel agents that are generally added to the paclitaxel component, which occurs first, but sometimes are extended through the anthracycline component as well, and in certain situations have actually replaced the paclitaxel component of chemotherapy. When you enroll onto I-SPY, you actually are screened. And of course, triple negative breast cancer is always going to be eligible for chemotherapy, but we screen patients with ER-positive disease as well as all comers getting the 70-gene mammoprint assay, and patients who are high risk go on I-SPY. All patients with triple negative and HER2-positive disease are also eligible, but this allows us to get a number of different genomic markers as well. Patients are then randomized after they've had their staging scans, their MRIs, the biopsy, and the mammoprint comes back to one of the arms of the trial. You actually are consented again because you have an opportunity not to participate in the trial if you're not happy with the arm that you're randomized to, of course. And we go through the specific toxicity of the randomized arm. I don't think for any patient that you can really take in, you know, 5 different arms of a trial and all the different toxicities. So it's much better, I think, to be able to randomize for screening and then randomize again once you're in the arm. This patient was randomized to our control arm, which is weekly paclitaxel for 12 weeks, followed by doxorubicin and cyclophosphamide, generally given dose dense for 4 weeks, and then surgery. You know, in our I-SPY trial, just like any trial, the patient is the important person here. And so we actually see the patients weekly. And if we feel like the response is not very good, we get MRIs periodically as well for the study. Then we can always change gears. You know, for example, you could add carboplatin at some point if you felt that response was not great. I like the idea of not giving carboplatin to everyone, although we may be evolving as a field to giving carboplatin to more patients with triple negative disease. My main concerns are that it does increase toxicity and bone marrow suppression makes it a little harder, and also that it is more toxic to the ovaries for patients who are young.
So I'm just kind of curious. This lady, I guess, is actually an ongoing patient, and she got randomized to the control arm, but what were some of the novel agents that she might have been eligible to receive? What are you looking at in I-SPY and triple negative right now?
Well, we've been looking at checkpoint inhibitors. So we had a pembrolizumab arm that included pembrolizumab with paclitaxel for 4 doses. And that one we've, of course, presented and hopefully will be published in the not too distant future that showed a marked improvement in PCR, not just in triple negative disease, but in the high risk hormone receptor positive cohort of patients enrolled on I-SPY. And actually, that was the first hormone receptor positive high risk group to graduate in I-SPY with the addition of a novel agent. And I think that's a really interesting area moving forward. But we extended it to include pembrolizumab through AC and pembrolizumab after paclitaxel. So that was one area. We've also studied an antibody drug conjugate called LIV-1A. We've studied the combination of a checkpoint inhibitor durvalumab and a very low dose of the PARP inhibitor olaparib. And then we have a number of other areas that we're also studying. One is to try and improve the response to checkpoint inhibitors. We know from the metastatic setting that only 40% of patients had the tumor immune cells that express PD-L1 and seemed to benefit from the addition of atezolizumab in IMpassion 130. And, you know, the whole idea is to have more patients benefit. So one way to have them benefit is to treat them earlier in the course of disease when they have more tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and more PD-L1 expression. But the other is to use some kind of immune agonist approach. And we have a TLR9 agonist called SD101 that's actually injected directly into the tumor to try and enhance, sort of recruit immune cells from the host. And then that's given with pembrolizumab and paclitaxel together before we go onto the AC. So that's another arm. And then we're always, you know, as arms close, we have new arms that are opening all the time.
So yeah, I want to spend really most of the time talking about some of the newer agents that are coming out in triple negative disease. But I have to ask you one thing. So we already have seen some pretty interesting data in renal, metastatic renal, checkpoint inhibitor with TKI, VEGF TKI, for example, axitinib, and there's another one. And there was a poster at ASCO that I'm wondering if you were exposed to. It was just a poster, and it was in colon and gastric cancer that was MSS stable. And they saw a whole bunch of responses to nivolumab plus regorafenib.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
So do you know anything about that? Is it possible that maybe we are going to find the combinations that were objective responses? Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, one of the problems is when you use an active agent along with another and you have a small study, you don't really know what the novel agent is adding in. But I have to say, you know, we have some intriguing data with, you know, using a checkpoint inhibitor and adding in something that in preclinical settings may be an immune agonist, essentially. And, you know, maybe it will be a TKI, maybe it'll be another antibody. We don't really know. I mean, there's data with bevacizumab and checkpoint inhibitors. There's data with MEK inhibitors, immune agonists, and, you know, there was a fascinating study just published that we've seen presented a couple of times called the TONIC trial, where patients received actually a really short induction of standard treatments, you know, a little cisplatin, a little oral cyclophosphamide, a dose of radiation, a couple doses of doxorubicin, low dose, and then they went on. They didn't continue that. That was just a two-week induction. Then they went on and received just a single checkpoint inhibitor. And these were patients with triple negative disease, a study done in the Netherlands. And what they saw, what's fascinating, was that there were very good responses. You know, it's a tiny study. And they found that doxorubicin and cisplatin might be the best immune agonist. But they also did all this laboratory studies looking at gene expression, induction of CD8 positive T cells, TILs, and they really saw very, very encouraging and exciting results. So they now have a phase 2 trial that's larger, looking specifically at the immune agonists that they thought were most effective. But I think that this is what the future is right now, is looking at ways to try and enhance the effect of this checkpoint inhibition and immune agonists in patients who have breast cancer and in all subtypes.
So let's just finish up with your patient, because I want to get into new agents, new directions, and maybe, you know, the beginning of moving out the survival curve with triple negative disease that you were talking about earlier. Let's just finish out, though, with this lady who got the standard arm of paclitaxel followed by AC. How did she actually do? Did she do the cooling cap? Do most of your patients do the cooling cap?
Many do, but I have to say patients who are receiving AC,
we
don't. And also remember that if you get weekly paclitaxel plus AC, that's actually 16 different chemotherapy infusions, and it's a lot of time to spend. You know, it's an extra hour and a half after paclitaxel and 2 hours after AC. We actually have a new cap design for one of the automated cooling systems that actually individually can be shaped to the head. And I'm very hopeful that this is going to work even better with AC, because now the success rate is maybe 30%. So with this new cap, maybe we'll see better responses. So she chose not to use the cooling cap in part because of the fact that insurance doesn't cover it. And secondly, because she was interested in continuing to work and continue with her training program and not take the extra time with the scalp cooling. She actually, you know, it's interesting. So she started with paclitaxel. She was really, really worried about neuropathy because, you know, felt that it would really affect her work. And after 2-3 weeks, she actually had quite a bit of tingling in her fingertips and toes. So one of the things I did, which is non-standard, but allowed within iSpy, and I do it quite frequently, is I changed her to nab-paclitaxel because You know, first of all, there is data from the German group that suggests that nab-paclitaxel may have some advantage in triple-negative disease. It's not definitive data, but it's interesting, recently published. And secondly, you know, nab-paclitaxel at 100 milligrams per meter squared in the metastatic setting had much less neuropathy than we see with paclitaxel. And these were in patients, you know, in the Blum study that had previous paclitaxel. So they were at higher risk for peripheral neuropathy. So I did change her to nab-paclitaxel, and you know, although this is just an individual patient, she did very well with it.
Just curious, I've heard people anecdotally talk about having patients hold bags of frozen peas and stuff like that. Do you ever do that?
Well, so I'm not big on the frozen peas. And Charles Laprinzi at Mayo is really interested in using these, you know, cold, like bags of ice, you know, that people would hold. I don't think that the cooling, and he doesn't either now, think that the cooling is efficient enough. So you can actually buy gloves that you freeze. And it turns out that probably for this to work well, you have to have a frozen glove that you change if it warms up, and you can wear frozen booties, and it has to be closely applied. So it actually has some pressure. And we use that with scalp cooling. You know, we actually put the cap on, and it has, you want it to really closely be opposed to the scalp. Same with the hands. So there's actually a group in Japan that showed that it might indeed reduce neuropathy. They put on one hand the cold glove and booty, and then on the other hand, they use as the control. So patients were their own control. They did see really, I thought, impressive results. And in Singapore, they've worked on these gloves that have some pressure applied to them. So actually, I'm very interested in this as a potential something to study as we get better and better cooling systems and maybe have one of these automated units where you have a glove. But now actually an increasing number of my patients, because of, you know, online discussions and blogs, et cetera, will purchase these cold gloves and freeze them and bring them in and use them to try and reduce the risk of neuropathy. I mean, the problem with neuropathy is we know a group of patients based on their pharmacogenomics are at higher risk, but we don't know how to identify them. And so, you know, it's hard to know who to advise. You know, you hate to see those patients who 2 years out still have enough neuropathy that can't wear their shoes, you know? So these patients are worried about it. She didn't use the frozen gloves, but we did switch to nab-paclitaxel. What was interesting about her course on the chemotherapy, which I found in a lot of professional women, is that, and not to say that it doesn't happen to everybody, but I think people think of themselves in general as being invincible and that there's a lot of mind over matter. And for these young women, of course, the matter overtakes the mind eventually. You know, you feel tired and a little nauseated and your hair falls out and you get a little depressed. You know, they're in menopause. There's a lot of issues that go on. And that, of course, was the case for this woman as well. The other thing I see with the young women is that they sometimes actually have a lot of toxicity with AC. So I would love it, you know, if we knew who needed AC or didn't in the neoadjuvant setting. And there's some fascinating work going on in that area as well, using docetaxel carboplatin backbone that our colleague Priyanka Sharma has been working on in Kansas. And, you know, I think that you do trade some toxicity in terms of nausea throughout, but if you could avoid the AC, that would be nice for a number of reasons. Anyway, she has had a fabulous clinical response and imaging response on MRI, but has really struggled, I think, physically and psychologically with the treatment.
I'm sure, and I wonder, I'm sure it must be pretty interesting to go to work as a, she's working as a clinician?
Well, eventually, I always say to people, you know, let's take it week by week. She did work in her capacity for the first probably 12 weeks during the paclitaxel, although she found it increasingly hard. And, you know, I said to women, if you burn the candle at both ends, it can be harder and harder to get through the chemo. But by the time she got to AC, she was willing to take off on short-term disability, which was really critical.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience, I'm sure, particularly for somebody who is going to be seeing patients. You wonder how it affects their perception. We once did a roundtable of 12 radiation oncologists, urologists, and medical oncologists who had prostate cancer.
Oh, fascinating.
And it was really interesting. You know, some of these people had, you know, very low grade, 100% curable, and were completely convinced they were going to die for sure. So you wonder, when people go through it, when they go back to practice, you know, how it affects the way they see their patients.
Well, you know, one thing that's intriguing, I think, and, you know, this is all anecdotal data, but in general, my physician patients, and sometimes others, but a lot of time physician patients were just working incredibly long hours and seeing sick patients, and you know, they push and push in the beginning to work through the chemotherapy. They get to the surgery and they're like done. You know, they need time to recover physically and psychologically and sort of get back on track. So a number of my patients have really needed to take, you know, time off, 6 months, sometimes 12 months after they finish, in order to really get back on track and adjust to the fact that you are a survivor, or some people say thriver, you know, where you really are on the other end of something that was really terrifying and you're still sort of getting through that and surviving, you know, whether or not you're on hormone therapy or you're done with chemo and sort of hoping that the cancer doesn't ever come back.
So, yeah, and really can imagine how much that would affect the way people see their patients in their own practice and, you know, how they relate to them. So let's, we start out here. This lady sounds like she's on her way in a positive direction. It'll be interesting to see what happens 5 and 10 years from now. Maybe she'll have kids and be successful in practice. That would be really, really inspiring and great, and I'm sure it happens a lot. Let's hear about your 61-year-old lady, because I want to spend most of our time now talking about metastatic disease and new developments. So what happened with this lady?
So this woman actually was in another part of the United States when she originally was diagnosed with a breast cancer. She felt a mass in her breast a few years ago and then had a 2.1 centimeter high-grade cancer, negative nodes, and triple negative. So she received standard adjuvant chemotherapy with dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel and then radiation therapy because she had breast-conserving surgery, appropriately so. It's interesting, you know, would we now give that patient neoadjuvant therapy? I have to say, for triple negative disease, I really like to give neoadjuvant therapy, just like HER2 positive breast cancer, for any tumor that's 2 centimeters or greater, and maybe even that some of the T1Cs, you know, because you could maybe use the more of the non-anthracycline-based regimen if they have a great response. So, you know, 2015, maybe a different approach. Now, if I could see a patient like that, even though they have surgically accessible disease, I would really consider doing neoadjuvant therapy versus adjuvant.
And, you know, a lot of people, I think there's been already a major shift towards, you know, we did a big project looking at this in terms of HER2 positive and triple negative using neoadjuvant therapy. The surgeons like it because it gives them a better chance to get good margins. You can maybe avoid axillary dissection, a lot of advantages. But now you have a new model out there in terms of the Catherine trial and HER2 positive disease, really pushing people to use neoadjuvant because now it gives you the post-op ammunition, a different ammunition in T-DM1. And maybe, do you think that could be the way we'll end up evolving in triple negative disease as these new agents come into practice?
I hope so. I think that, you know, we have two ways of trying to modify treatment based on response, and that's our only chance. You know, it really is. And, you know, look at the huge data from Catherine, so impressive, really changed practice right away in the U.S. But we also have CREATE-X for triple negative disease, where the subset of patients who had triple negative disease had the improved overall survival. And, you know, although I think most of us think of capecitabine as not being our favorite drug in triple negative breast cancer, the data has really changed the standard of care all around the world because, you know, the patients live longer. You can't argue it with survival. So I think that we already have data in triple negative disease. The other thing is that it may be that we can alter therapy, although we need to prove that still, in the neoadjuvant setting based on response. So if you have a sluggish response early, maybe going on and adding in different treatments will allow us to better individualize therapy for patients and not give everything to everybody. So, you know, I do think it's critical and it should already be incorporated into practice, but I think it will be even more so as we move forward.
So let's talk about your 61-year-old lady diagnosed with triple-negative breast cancer in 2015. What happened then?
So then she actually had a routine colonoscopy 3 years later and had an adenocarcinoma of the colon that eventually was resected and cured by resection. But at that time, and she doesn't have any germline mutations, interestingly, but then she had a chest x-ray in preparation for moving forward with definitive treatment of her colon cancer and had concern for lung nodules. So then she had staging scans with a CT of chest and abdomen, and it showed lung nodules and mediastinal adenopathy. So they basically went ahead and resected her colon mass because that was already planned like 2 days after her CT scan and found a colon cancer with negative nodes. But then she went on and had a PET CT after her surgery, which showed these lung nodules and mediastinal adenopathy that was all FTG avid. And on biopsy, that was a triple negative breast cancer, similar to her original cancer.
Could I just ask how comfortable you were that this was her breast cancer, not her colon cancer or something else?
Yeah, I mean, it had markers that looked just like breast cancer. It wasn't a colon cancer. So, you know, you can actually go and do a lot of markers in the biopsy sample and tell the cell of origin unless a tumor is highly de-differentiated. I mean, sometimes, you know, these carcinomas of unknown primary, you know, you just can't tell where it comes from. Sometimes you can rule out a few organs. But in this situation, this was adenocarcinoma of the breast in her mediastinal nodes. It's a very good point and an important part of her staging. You know, the colon cancer needed to be resected.
If she were ER positive or HER2 positive, it would have made it a little bit more straightforward, I would have thought, although you can see HER2 positive colon cancer too.
Yeah, and you can sometimes see expression of ER. So you really need the other markers that tell you, you know, cytokeratin, et cetera, that will give you some information about this. And they did do markers to show that this was a breast cancer origin.
It is interesting when you think about the path that a patient takes, triple negative breast cancer versus, let's say, metastatic colon cancer, very different treatments. Not sure the long-term outcome is that much different, but just interesting how different the therapies are.
Yeah, the therapies are different. I mean, some colon cancers, like breast cancers, patients can live a long time with incurable disease, and it's probably a little less common in poorly responsive triple-negative breast cancer. But, and, you know, there are a number of targeted agents now, so.
I was going to ask you before with your other patient, the younger patient, but I'll bring it up here because I think it's relevant too, which is when you see a patient who now is diagnosed with metastatic triple-negative disease, 61 years old, I think no family history. What kind of germline or somatic mutation workup do you think is appropriate at that point?
Well, you know, in this patient, she actually was under the age of 60 when she was diagnosed. So she had germline testing then, which showed no mutations. But at 61, you know, this is under the age of 60, there are a number of different series that have looked at patients who were tested. And if you have no family history and triple negative disease over the age of 60, the incidence of germline mutations, certainly in BRCA1 and 2, is very low. But, you know, I think you have to individualize it based on the patient. And in general, the oncologic community has leaned more towards testing patients who have metastatic disease because we have the option of giving PARP inhibitors to patients who have germline mutations in BRCA1 and 2. Even patients who are over the age of 60. That's not in our guidelines, mainly because the incidence of the mutations is so low. But in a patient who has, you know, children, et cetera, I think at some point you really have to think about whether or not it's worthwhile doing some sort of testing, looking for also other germline mutations that may have a lower incidence of breast cancer associated with mutations, but still would be important for counseling.
So let me just clarify this because I think it is a very important practical point. In the older patient, for example, and in an age where oncologists are looking for NTRK fusions and all kinds of other stuff that's not too common because we have good therapies or at least somewhat effective therapies. Obviously, you mentioned PARP inhibitors. So for sure, BRCA germline, I'd say BRCA somatic. And then you get into the whole arena of like what I hear people calling different things, but DNA repair deficiency, which sometimes I hear people say, oh, they have that, let's try a PARP inhibitor. But what would you say about, forget 61, 70-year-old woman, no family history, if you do panel germline testing and, you know, say NGS or something, what's the chance that you're going to find something you might want to try a PARP inhibitor in for metastatic disease? I'm talking about somatic mutations that people group under the DNA repair, you know, all kinds of things I've never heard about, right. But there's a whole bunch of things like that.
Well, it actually, you know, it's been easier with the use of NGS and, you know, some drugs that are approved based, you know, that are disease agnostic and, you know, based on NGS, because if you get NGS, of course, you're getting the germline too. And so if you see a mutation, if you haven't gotten germline testing, you can go back and actually just look at the germline to see whether that's germline or somatic. So that actually gives us a way of doing testing, even though it falls outside of our general guidelines for just germline diffuse testing. You get any mutation there. The chance in a 70-year-old of finding something is relatively small. You know, I think that we're certainly in the less than 10% category, and probably in a 70-year-old with triple-negative breast cancer, probably in the even less than that. I don't know that we have full data on metastatic disease looking at somatic mutations in triple-negative breast cancer. They're fairly uncommon, so you're really looking at a very small number. We also don't know what the efficacy is of these PARP inhibitors in patients who have somatic mutations or alternative germline DNA repair defect mutations. And that's being studied actually in a trial that we have within our Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium that's being run by Nadine Tung in Boston. And I think really fascinating because, you know, even for PALB, which involves BRCA, we don't have approval for PARP inhibitors. So hopefully we'll learn a lot more from that trial as well as others that are going on.
So we did a meeting at AACR this year where we had a breast cancer person, an ovarian cancer person, a prostate cancer person, and a pancreatic person. And guess what they were all talking about? PARP inhibitors. And then when you start asking them, like, which somatic mutation, you know. So it is certainly an evolving area that is affecting a lot of different cancers. But in any event, this lady sounds like didn't have anything in that direction. But she did have a number of assays done that were interesting. So first, Mayo Clinic PD-L1 SP142 testing, 3% positive IHC. Foundation Medicine testing, T53 splice site, low TMB, MS stable. So how do you incorporate these pieces of data into thinking through her options?
You know, it's interesting. Although there are reports of patients having a MS unstable and higher tumor mutational burden, you know, it's extremely uncommon in breast cancer. And studies looking at patients who have intermediate or high tumor mutational burden really need to have multiple centers because it is so uncommon. There is some data suggesting it might be more common than we thought, but I just don't see it in my patients, really, maybe one ever. P53 is a common mutation that's seen loss of the tumor suppressor gene. We can't target it, and it's associated with more resistant and aggressive cancers, and we see it in all different types, but in triple-negative disease, it's not uncommon. The PD-L1 testing is interesting because this really comes from the FDA approval of atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel from the IMpassion 130 data, where the patients who benefited from the addition of atezolizumab were those who had tumor immune cells. So not the tumor cells, but tumor immune cells that were positive for PD-L1 using this Ventana SP142 antibody. And the patients who were defined as positive were 1% or greater. And so far in the analysis of the patients on those trials, we haven't seen a difference based on, you know, 3+ versus 2+ versus 1+ or, you know, higher percentage of positivity. So 1% or more was categorized as positive. And in those patients, we saw an improved survival, as you know, with the addition of atezolizumab. So this testing was done because the patient actually was more than a year from her adjuvant paclitaxel treatment. And so she would have been eligible for IMpassion 130. And doing PD-L1 testing tells you whether or not a patient would be eligible to receive atezolizumab.
I want you to go through those data and sort of what you think it means. But before we get to that, just again, to take a step back looking at this patient, I'm gathering she was asymptomatic, no pulmonary symptoms, but this imaging sounds a little bit scary. Like, were you concerned that maybe it was going to blow up into lymphangitic disease or something that would be a real problem?
You know, lymphangitic spread, obviously, we hate, right? This is a terrible consequence of metastatic disease. But having lung nodules and mediastinal adenopathy doesn't make me worry too much about lymphangitic spread. Mainly, we were worried about the nodes. And in fact, her lung nodules weren't that big. I mean, the biggest nodule was, you know, on the PET CT was 1.3 centimeters. You can see a lot of little nodules, and people can do pretty well with it for quite a while. Sometimes the adenopathy is a bigger issue because it causes compression of the bronchii or blood vessel compression or clots. So, you know, she really was asymptomatic, so I wasn't too worried about it right at that moment. And we know we're going to give chemo because we don't have another option first line. I wasn't going to give checkpoint inhibitor alone, especially with the IMpassion 130 data. So, you know, I think the chances she would respond to chemotherapy alone was pretty good. The issue here is duration of response.
And we didn't mention, but when she was initially diagnosed in 2015, she had adjuvant dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel. Did she have any residual neuropathy that was evident at the time that she had the metastatic disease?
She really doesn't at all. I mean, it's really fortunate. She did not have neuropathy. I think that because I didn't give her the original adjuvant chemotherapy, she said that during the paclitaxel, she had some tingling at her fingertips and toes, but it had completely resolved weeks after the end of her treatment. And it only came back when we gave her a number of cycles of nab-paclitaxel.
And I wanted to just start getting into the IMpassion data because she actually got treated with nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab, and you mentioned her 3% level. I'd like you to sort of go through that in terms of what the study looked at. But what actually happened with her when she was treated? What happened to the tumor? What happened to her?
Well, so she started with nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab per the IMpassion 130 trial. Actually, she started getting it even before the FDA approval of the regimen. So, you know, it was nice because she was able to get atezolizumab based on the strength of the data that had been presented and published. And what she had a follow-up scan after receiving a couple of months of treatment and had a marked reduction in her disease. You know, her lung nodule, which had been 1.3 centimeters, was 4 millimeters. The mediastinal adenopathy had completely resolved. There were a few nodes you could see, but none of them had any standardized uptake value or SUV on the PET CT that she was getting. So then she continued along with her chemotherapy. And then I think one of the questions that came up then was, how long do we continue therapy for? You know, should we at some point drop the nab-paclitaxel and continue atezolizumab alone? We don't really know the answer to that yet. I hope that we do. You know, it's interesting with lung and node disease, some data has suggested that there are more TILs and greater maybe PD-L1 expression in lung and node versus, say, liver, where patients don't do as well. That may also correlate with a poorer outcome in patients who have very high LDH, that, you know, they tend to have a lot of liver disease. So hard to know. She had a follow-up PET CT, again, that showed essentially no residual hypermetabolic foci and just nothing left. So the idea is to maybe give her another couple of cycles and then at some point drop the nab-paclitaxel. She had, after receiving 6 cycles, some peripheral neuropathy and really significant fatigue and was feeling quite depressed about this, you know, that this quality of life was kind of miserable for her. So we talked about a couple of different ways to make it better for her, either giving 2 weeks on, 1 week off versus 3 weeks on, 1 week off, or dropping her dose of nab-paclitaxel. So we actually dropped her dose of nab-paclitaxel to 80 milligrams per meter squared from 100. And she's actually feeling much better and feels like her neuropathy is a little bit better. Again, I think that at some point we're going to have to give her a chemo holiday and continue atezolizumab alone. But because she has a PCR now, you know, having started in the beginning of February of this year, I'm very encouraged by her response and hoping that it will be durable. Interestingly, she's not had any immune toxicity at all.
I was going to ask you that. So nothing whatsoever. I'm guessing you're following her thyroid function.
So we check thyroid stimulating hormone on a regular basis. I think, you know, most of the trials did it every 6 weeks. You know, if people are fatigued, we end up getting it a little more frequently. Sometimes, well, it's every 8 weeks on that cycle. So sometimes we get it every 4 weeks. And particularly in patients who've had some abnormality of their TSH, you know, sometimes we see them become hyperthyroid first and then hypothyroid. So you really want to catch that abnormality. And then I have a very low threshold for doing additional testing. For example, if a patient develops a cough or diarrhea or other, you know, electrolyte abnormalities, et cetera, you know, creatinine problems. But in this patient, she's had zero.
So, of course, we hear that story and that type of story in many different kinds of cancers nowadays. It's becoming kind of a little bit of a checkpoint world. But sort of globally, when you look at patients with breast cancer, maybe they're a little bit younger. As you look out over, let's say, a year, for example, in the metastatic setting, what's your usual estimate for the likelihood they're going to have a thyroid abnormality, the likelihood they're going to have something else?
I would say somewhere between 5 to 10% of our patients have a thyroid abnormality. It's interesting. You know, it would be interesting to look at time frames in terms of safety in our studies going on with checkpoint inhibitors and breast cancer. I have a tendency to believe that if you're going to get an immune toxicity, you tend to get it early. There's been some time courses in the articles published over the last couple of years, you know, kind of interesting, where you can actually see late immune toxicity with colitis and pneumonitis and other kinds of things like that. And I'm sure that's true for thyroid. It's just that, you know, most of the cases we tend to uncover relatively early. You know, it's interesting. I've seen patients who've developed relatively severe colitis and relatively severe rash with exposure to a single dose of checkpoint inhibition. So it doesn't seem to be so related to having, you know, lots and lots of exposure to the checkpoint inhibitor, although, you know, you do accumulate more cases over time. Those are rare, but if you treat a lot of patients with checkpoint inhibitors on clinical trials, you're going to see more of this, and you have to have a fairly high suspicion. You know, I had a patient also who had cytopenias, one patient. You know, you can count them all, right? You know, because these are unusual toxicities. I've never seen renal toxicity, for example. I've never seen cardiac toxicity or pulmonary toxicity.
I've heard it all. I've heard everything. Yeah. Sitting in this chair, everything. Cardiomyopathy.
I bet.
But, you know, I was trying to think, what triggered me to ask you about thyroid? And now I know what it was when we first started hearing about checkpoint inhibitors in Hodgkin lymphoma. And they're, you know, again, you're seeing younger people, and they were saying, oh, yeah, we got to really keep an eye on the thyroid. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe it has something to do with age or whatever.
I don't think that, so far we really haven't seen any variation in age where we see really, I would say overall the population I treat might be a little bit younger than the global population of breast cancer just because of the nature of my practice, but we see it across the board.
Of course, this issue of atezolizumab and the triple negative is a huge story. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about the biology and the immunology of breast cancer, what we learned initially about monotherapy and how we ended up here? Like now, a lot of cancers, lung cancer, head and neck cancer, bladder maybe, chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor. Can you kind of go through that story?
Well, so, you know, it's actually fascinating because when I was training and I was a fellow a long, long time ago now, we were giving interleukin-2 to patients and they would go in the ICU and be so sick and the renal cell and melanoma patients were being treated. And at that time, we really believed that breast cancer was immunologically dead, you know, that the breast cells look so much like itself that you just didn't react to them. And of course, that is true for the most frequent form of breast cancer in older women. So ER-positive, lower-grade breast cancers have very little immune activity. But for the more aggressive subtypes that we've identified subsequent to that time, triple-negative disease, HER2-positive breast cancer, and very proliferative ER-positive disease. So, you know, this sort of very high-risk ER-positive disease, very proliferative. What we do see in those patients is we see tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. And in the early stage setting, the presence of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, and Shireen Loy has done some beautiful work on this in triple-negative disease, as well as others, have correlated with outcome, where patients who have more of these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes have a better outcome. We also have found that PD-L1 expression is increased on these more aggressive cancers and that both tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes and expression of PD-L1 seems to decrease as tumors go from the early to late stage setting. And as they go throughout the late stage setting, they become less and less immune sensitive. So we actually learned, we kind of went backwards in this in a little bit. We learned first that there was some activity of immune checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer. And this was astonishing to us. You know, we're like, wow, it's so exciting. These were basket trials. We saw response rates of 18.5% to 19%. On some of those patients, I mean, who cares about a response rate under 20%? It's because the responders had this great outcome where their overall survival was huge. I mean, it's just, you look at those curves and you know that you're really onto something very exciting. And the treatment was well tolerated, recognizing now that we have to, of course, be on top of the immune toxicity. So what happened then was these expansion trials were developed with pembrolizumab and atezolizumab in patients who had triple negative disease, including first and greater lines of therapy. And what we found from both of these trials was that the response rates in patients who are in the second line or greater, of course, there were many patients who are, you know, farther along the road than second line, the response rates were quite low in the probably less than 5% or 5% range. So very, very low. But if you treated patients in the first line setting, you got response rates sort of combining the two studies in the 25% or so range. And those responses could be quite durable. Interestingly, in the study where they looked at, you know, second or greater line therapy, we didn't select for PD-L1 positivity. But in the first line trial, we did select for PD-L1 positivity in the pembrolizumab trial. And with the atezolizumab, there was a suggestion of potentially better responses in PD-L1 positive disease. Again, small numbers there looking at that subset. So that was really exciting. It made us go back and do some of those studies, which I mentioned have shown that you actually start turning down your immune response and decreasing PD-L1 expression as the cancer progresses. We've also learned that where the cancer metastasizes to may make a difference as well. Hard to know. So that actually, you know, if you go back to the laboratory and animal models and see, and in humans, see that if you give chemotherapy, you can enhance the immune infiltration of tumors in some cases. That sort of led to the IMPASSION 130 trial, which was the idea of giving chemotherapy and a checkpoint inhibitor to see if you can improve outcome, looking at progression-free and overall survival. At the same time, in parallel, the idea was maybe if we treated even earlier in the course of the disease, we could change outcome. So a bunch of neoadjuvant studies started up that extended the checkpoint inhibitor through the adjuvant setting and were really stimulated by this PCR marked improvement we saw in the I-SPY 2 phase 2 adaptively randomized trial. So IMPASSION 130, you know, is a fascinating trial, now published and updated and led to FDA approval of the combination. It enrolled patients who had triple negative breast cancer that were at least a year out from their adjuvant or neoadjuvant taxane chemotherapy. Patients were randomized to receive nab-paclitaxel with placebo or nab-paclitaxel with atezolizumab. We used 100 milligrams per meter squared, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And I really feel that was a critical decision because when we made that decision as a group, there was a lot of interest in using higher doses of nab-paclitaxel, 125 milligrams per meter squared. The problem with that is that you get a lot of neuropathy and patients sort of fall off. They can't continue the treatment. So I'm really pleased that we chose the 100 milligram per meter squared for this metastatic trial. The endpoints are interesting because there was a lot of interest in understanding whether PD-L1 positivity would make a difference in response to atezolizumab. So the primary endpoint was progression-free survival in the intent-to-treat arm, and if that was positive, looking at the PD-L1 subset population, along with overall survival in intent-to-treat, and then if that was positive, looking at the PD-L1 positive population.
Could I just clarify one thing? In terms of the percent of patients globally in this situation who have greater than 1%?
So we didn't know. I mean, that was the thing. You know, who knew?
But what do we know
we
now?
We didn't have exactly that trial population. So we know now. And it was 41% of the trial population that had immune cells that were at least 1% positive for PD-L1 using the Ventana SP142 assay.
So most patients did not?
Most patients did not, 60%, which is why it's so incredibly important that we're pursuing these sort of combinations of immune agonists with checkpoint inhibitors. But not only that, that we're moving the treatment earlier in the course of therapy because it may not actually matter as much if you have PD-L1 positive disease in the neoadjuvant setting or adjuvant setting. And we're going to learn a lot more about that in the next actually very short time period based on a press release suggesting that patients had a better PCR from a phase 3 trial using pembrolizumab in the neoadjuvant setting regardless of PD-L1 positivity using a different assay, I'll point out. An assay which marks most tumors as PD-L1 positive.
But just to clarify, though, in terms of the actual overall results of the study, as well as the results within the 1% population, in terms of hazard ratios and absolute differences, progression-free survival, response rate, survival.
Well, so, you know, I think that in this trial, probably the absolute differences are more important to us than the hazard ratios. What we saw was something fascinating to me, had been seen in other diseases, actually, with immune therapy, and was part of the reason why patients could not be unblinded in the trial. So even after their disease progressed, they couldn't be unblinded because the hypothesis was that immune therapy might impact survival more than it impacted progression-free survival. It's actually fascinating that in the CLEOPATRA trial, we saw that. Big PFS difference, but actually almost three times greater difference in overall survival. And again, you know, we know HER2-targeted therapy has an immune effect as well. So the idea is that you change the tumor microenvironment, and so subsequent therapies work better, and you live longer, even though potentially you don't have a much longer disease control rate with the first-line therapy. So we saw that in PASSION. Fascinating. The difference in progression-free survival, I remember when we first saw that data, the difference in progression-free survival in the intent-to-treat population was less than 2 months. Significant, but, you know, really using an expensive drug, potential toxicities, is it worth it? Then we looked at the PD-L1 positive population, and that was more impressive with this difference that was in the 2.5-month range. So, you know, maybe more worthwhile treating patients. But then when we looked at overall survival, no significant difference in the whole population intent-to-treat. By the original design, then you wouldn't look at the PD-L1 positive population. But of course, you have that data. So you look, and it was a 10-month difference, striking, something we don't see by chance. And the FDA actually agreed with that. And that data led to the approval for patients who have PD-L1 positive disease. In longer follow-up, that was just the first interim analysis. At the second interim analysis that was recently presented, we saw a difference of 7 months in overall survival. There is no other therapy that has that impact in triple-negative metastatic breast cancer. Unfortunately, it was only seen in the PD-L1 positive population. It's fortunate in that it's more precision medicine. We can identify the group that benefits. Unfortunate in that there's 60% of patients who don't have PD-L1 positive disease, where we need to keep looking for ways of improving response to immune therapy.
So I want to weave in the next topic, which is PARP inhibitors and triple negative disease. And I want to hear about your patient, your 43-year-old woman who ended up getting a PARP inhibitor. And of course, I want to hear about the data and what your take is on it. But just to introduce it, just out of curiosity, I want you to think about this same patient you just discussed with the lung nodules that you ended up giving the NAB and atezolizumab to. And I guess my question is, what would you have done if you knew she had a BRCA germline mutation?
I would have treated her the same way. I think there's a lot of interest in giving PARP inhibitors with checkpoint inhibitors because there's some data that you can goose up the immune system via the STING pathway through interferon-mediated cell inflammation. And so, you know, the data from two phase two studies, not randomized, you know, looks pretty intriguing. And there's now randomized studies going on and also subgroup studies going on. But there's a lot of interest in using, I mean, this is sort of not in any way the approval for PARP inhibitors, but there's interest in using that combination as maintenance therapy after chemo. I was talking about this patient. I mean, boy, you get chemo fatigue. I mean, you know, you're looking, oh, you know, my median survival is 18, you know, is, I have to say, 7-month improvement in survival means your median survival is a little over 2 years. It's not like great. So this patient, I think, will live appreciably longer, but she's depressed. She doesn't want to stay on chemo forever, you know, can't travel as far.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that's about the chemo. You could always keep the atezolizumab going, but
right.
I'm just talking practical right now, practical.
Right, so this is practical. So you drop the chemo. So in this patient, if she had a BRCA mutation, the idea would be you'd still start with the treatment that's been demonstrated to improve survival. But as she's saying, you know, complaining about her chemo fatigue, et cetera, you could say, well, you know, we could always drop the chemo, continue atezolizumab, and, you know, we're studying adding in PARP inhibitors in this setting. Let's say you didn't want to take that exploratory approach, which is being studied in trials. You could say, well, we'll drop the chemo, continue atezolizumab, and if your cancer progresses, we could either add back in chemo or we could give a PARP inhibitor, oral therapy, pretty well tolerated, and this would be a great option for you. And it's an option for her after the atezolizumab chemotherapy combination stops working as well. And I think most of us would now use it as a second line approach, given the fact that we have survival data in the first line.
You know, it's so interesting because when we ask oncologists, we present cases of metastatic breast cancer and BRCA germline, and a lot of them talk about using chemo followed by PARP maintenance because they're used to that from ovary. It makes complete sense to them. And then we go, yeah, but there's no data in breast cancer on it. But yet it's just so appealing. It makes so much sense. And as you're saying, clinically, it makes a lot of sense. But let's bring in the data because obviously it sounds like you're more impressed with the bump that the PD-L1 positive patients get in survival. And that makes a lot of sense. But I do want to find out how you approach the issue of particularly genetic testing and integration of PARP inhibitors and which one, common question for oncology. You know, there's 6 checkpoint inhibitors that are approved nowadays. Anyhow, 3 CDK inhibitors, et cetera. But we've got 2 PARP inhibitors approved in breast cancer. So anyhow, let's hear about your 43-year-old lady. What happened with her?
Well, this is a really tragic case, as many of our patients are who have metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. A 43-year-old woman who had a triple-negative breast cancer, she actually had surgery first. Unfortunately, you know, I don't like that approach so much. And she had a 4.3-centimeter triple-negative breast cancer with LVI and 4 positive nodes with extracapsular extension, so stage 3 disease, really unfortunate. She actually had a family history with a paternal grandmother at breast cancer at age 50 and a paternal cousin. And this is actually a real, you know, a sort of key. You should think BRCA mutations. This paternal cousin had both breast and ovarian cancer. In this case, the paternal cousin was known to have a BRCA mutation. But even if they'd not, you know, those two cancers together or any ovarian cancer is really a key, a male breast cancer. So this patient, unfortunately, did have a germline BRCA1 mutation. And she received standard adjuvant chemotherapy. She received dose dense AC times 4, followed by weekly paclitaxel. But actually, as she got to her 10th cycle, and this is sort of the our worst of worst in terms of triple negative breast cancer that presents with early stage, is cancer progression during neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy. So while she was getting her paclitaxel around cycle 10, and probably a little bit earlier, she started noticing redness on the left breast that spread over her reconstructed left breast, and had a skin punch biopsy around cycle 10 of paclitaxel that showed metastatic carcinoma, triple negative. So she went on to receive additional chemotherapy, but she got very intensive chemotherapy at another location, causing a lot of thrombocytopenia. She was really limited in her treatment due to thrombocytopenia at that time. So the cancer actually responded, even though with the limitation, and the redness actually resolved initially. So then she received radiation therapy, stopping the chemotherapy. Of course, the radiation therapy caused her to continue to be thrombocytopenic, which was unfortunate because it really hurts for us to treat low platelets. And then at the end of her radiation, she started on a PARP inhibitor. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. This is a patient who has metastatic disease, you know, recurrent inflammatory disease in skin, on her chest wall, you know, non-resectable disease, gets an induction chemotherapy and really was using olaparib in a sort of maintenance setting in this situation, knowing that she had, you know, really a terrible prognosis with growth on adjuvant paclitaxel. So she received olaparib and had her ovaries out. You know, she had her ovaries out at her local institution. I wouldn't have been really pushed to take her ovaries out at that time, but the plan had been made originally to take her ovaries out, so they went ahead actually with the surgery, and she felt better about doing that. She stayed on her olaparib for about 5.5 months. During that time, you know, we struggled a little bit with her platelets. Remember, this is a patient who has sort of an individual risk for thrombocytopenia. She didn't have any anemia, which is the most common cytopenia we see with PARP inhibitors, but her platelets, you know, kind of up and down, always under 100,000. So then she started having a recurrence on the contralateral breast after about 5 months of therapy. And it's really interesting with these patients with chest wall disease, you know, at that point she had no disease systemically, but the disease was increasing on her chest wall. And she then became more neutropenic. Her platelets were 50,000, so we stopped the olaparib in order to try and treat the progressing disease on her chest wall.
Maybe we can just take a breath here, and you know, this case obviously is very complicated, but I did want to get your take on the data with PARP inhibitors. Bottom line, we have two approved. What are the key phase 3 data that fed into that approval, and what's it mean in terms of how you approach patients and also how you test patients?
It's interesting. We participated in the phase 3 clinical trials with talazoparib, but I've also given quite a lot of olaparib. And in terms of the trials themselves, you know, two phase 3 trials with some differences, but not huge, treating patients who had germline BRCA1 or 2 mutations in the metastatic setting with either the PARP inhibitor or treatment of physician choice with the selection of chemotherapy agents, both showing a doubling essentially of response rates and improved progression-free survival. You know, the doubling of response you really see in clinic. I mean, you give these patients who don't have platinum-resistant disease. That was key for both of these trials. But, you know, you treat the patients and they respond rapidly. I mean, it's a very, very quick response, symptomatic improvement. And it lasts a reasonably long time compared to chemotherapy for triple-negative disease, but not long enough, you know? I mean, so if you have response, the duration, you know, median duration in the 7-month-ish range, you know, the patient's tumors develop resistance to these PARP inhibitors. So they were pretty well tolerated, with cytopenias being the most common toxicity, some nausea, which we see with PARP inhibitors and is really important to control dose reductions, treating with nausea medication. I use sometimes the antipsychotic drug olanzapine for that kind of nausea because, you know, you don't want to be nauseated continuously on an oral medication. Dose reduction for cytopenias and then anemia sometimes can be a big issue. It's difficult to compare the two agents in terms of toxicities because they were two trials, you know, two parallel trials. You can't really do cross-trial comparisons. So we don't know very well how to compare the two drugs. But I think the one thing we've learned from the Olympiad trial with olaparib from a subset analysis, which, you know, we hope to see an update for, was recently published actually, was looking at overall survival where, you know, somewhat disappointingly, there was no difference in overall survival comparing the PARP inhibitor to chemotherapy. But if you looked at the patients who were treated in the first line setting in a subset analysis, it looked like there was a bigger difference in overall survival. And that's actually resonated a lot with me because if you look at mechanisms of resistance in patients who have germline mutations to PARP inhibitors, where you see these, you know, sort of acquired acquisition of function of DNA repair, you actually correct the deficiency of DNA repair as a mutation. And then there are other mutations as well. You know, we think about triple negative disease where we see this plasticity and more resistance as you go down lines of therapy. It makes perfect sense that that would apply for PARP inhibitors, so that using the drugs earlier makes a lot of sense in the first line setting, depending on what your options are, or second line setting. And that's where the interest in maintenance is. Of course, you know, we're waiting for results from the Olympia trial, which is using the PARP inhibitor olaparib in the adjuvant setting. And then we saw this really intriguing data with talazoparib in the neoadjuvant setting in only 19 patients from Jennifer Litton from MD Anderson, where the pathologic CR rates were really astonishingly high from just getting a PARP inhibitor as a single agent if you had a germline BRCA mutation. So I think where that puts me is that, you know, I want to test patients who have metastatic triple negative disease for sure. Most of the patients have already been tested because we have NGS, as we have talked about. We get the germline testing in some ways an early look. Younger patients are generally tested in the early stage setting or right away when they come in with metastatic disease. So we know if we can use these agents. We're exploring greater use across other germline mutations and somatic mutations, although we don't have data yet. Even looking at ctDNA or plasma to look for somatic mutations is a fascinating new area of exploration. The choice of what PARP inhibitor to use and when to give it is a big question. You know, if you have horrible early stage breast cancer with tons of residual disease, you know, that's even a setting where I would consider using a PARP inhibitor off-label because those patients have such a poor prognosis and we really want to alter their outcome. You know, whether you use a olaparib or talazoparib, in some ways it takes us back to the aromatase inhibitors and the CDK4/6 inhibitors, you know, I just alternate because I don't know. And I think by alternating, I get the greatest experience using the drugs. If a patient doesn't tolerate one, I'll switch to another. And I don't feel like I need to use one over the other in this situation.
So the fact that you do alternate them obviously suggests that you can't distinguish benefit from the two drugs. You mentioned tolerability, and I think I've heard people talk about alopecia with talazoparib.
I haven't seen a lot of alopecia with either talazoparib or olaparib, and certainly not as much as I've seen with the CDK4/6 inhibitors, for example.
Is there anything with talazoparib, anything that distinguishes?
People are concerned about more anemia.
Yeah, but they both cause anemia, right? I mean, can you tell the difference?
A little more anemia, maybe some variations in nausea between the two drugs. Those are the two main side effects.
But nothing qualitative?
No, not really. Well, I mean, if you have nausea all the time, it's a big qualitative effect.
Yeah, no, but what I mean is different new, you know, kinds of side effects. It's just the same kind.
No, it's interesting. You know, I saw a lot about the anemia and have had, you know, people talk about how they manage it. Didn't really have patients with anemia. You know, patient with thrombocytopenia, I've had some patients with that before. But I recently had a patient who had BRCA2, and interestingly, actually she has a BRCA1 mutation and ER-positive metastatic disease, very young woman. And she had transfusion requiring anemia on talazoparib. I mean, she needed blood every 2 weeks. So we actually dose reduced her and eventually changed to olaparib, and her transfusion requirement went away. I don't know if it was the change because we didn't wait long enough with the dose reduction on talazoparib or whether or not there was something else going on, but it was really quite dramatic from when we started until now when she has no transfusion requirement and a normal hemoglobin.
So there's so much more to talk about, but I just want to end here with a couple of thoughts about antibody drug conjugates. Which ones are out there and are any of them likely to come into clinical practice?
I do think they will come into clinical practice, and I hope very much in the near future. There are two, I think probably our two most exciting ADCs in terms of the data available are sacituzumab govitecan, which is the TROP2 targeted ADC that's been studied in triple negative disease. The toxin is SN38, the active metabolite of irinotecan. That data is actually quite encouraging with a 30%+ response rate in heavily pretreated metastatic triple negative breast cancer that appears to be reasonably durable. You know, side effects of what you would expect with chemotherapy, but able to be controlled, some hair loss and nausea, cytopenias. But we've actually figured out how to control all of those fairly easily.
I have to say, though, that, you know, when you think about the other antibody drug conjugates that are out there, T-DM1 and brentuximab and lymphomas, you don't hear that much. I mean, peripheral neuropathy and all, but you don't hear much about chemotherapy side effects. So you're saying this agent actually causes chemotherapy side effects?
It causes chemotherapy side effects, as do the two other ones that I'll talk about briefly. So there is some difference. And what that difference is due to, we're not sure. I don't think it's due to the toxin. I think it has to do with the number of drugs per antibody. So, you know, you can load up now with new linkers and new technologies more of the toxin per antibody, and that may have something to do with it. And it may have something to do with the linker and the metabolism of the linker itself. So sacituzumab actually has been studied in a phase 3 trial called the ASCENT trial, which is mostly completed accrual. There's a little bit of PK work going on, but it completed the main study accrual, randomizing to sacituzumab versus treatment of physician choice in patients who received at least 2 lines of prior chemotherapy for metastatic disease. So a really bad situation for our patients. And we're really excited to see that data, I hope next year, from this ASCENT trial. Sacituzumab is also being tested now in the TROPiCS trial in hormone receptor positive disease, where there were some very encouraging data as well recently presented. So that's one ADC, I think, has very encouraging data in triple negative disease. The second ADC actually has been tested in HER2-positive disease, trastuzumab DS8201. That has a novel toxin, exatecan, derivative, and linked to a trastuzumab, essentially biosimilar. And that has shown some really remarkable responses in patients who have resistant HER2-positive disease. But in patients who had a new category of cancer that's been defined really by this agent called HER2-low disease, 1-plus and 2-plus expression, no FISH amplification, those patients also had a very impressive response that seemed to be quite durable. A subset of patients with triple-negative disease will have 1-plus expression of HER2 by IHC and could be eligible for that agent. There's now a phase 3 trial going on comparing DS8201 to treatment of physician choice in patients who have HER2-low metastatic breast cancer. Again, limits on line of therapy. So it's incredibly important if you're thinking about these trials for your patients to explore them early, because there are always going to be limits on line of therapy. So if you use up all your therapy, they won't be eligible for the trials. We hope to see accelerated approval of sacituzumab and potentially trastuzumab DS8201 sometime in the not terribly distant future based on the efficacy data we've already seen presented and in some cases published. There's a third ADC that's actually being tested in TNBC called ladiratuzumab. And ladiratuzumab is an ADC to LIV-1A, and its toxin is MMAE, an auristatin analog. That agent has been tested. It has some efficacy as a single agent, a little bit of neuropathy and cytopenias, some other toxicities associated with the auristatin analog. There's been some very interesting data in combination with checkpoint inhibitors. Of course, now the next wave is to combine all of these ADCs with checkpoint inhibitors and see if we can further enhance the activity. Since the antibodies have an immune effect, you can enhance the immune effect and give the chemo to enhance the sort of goose up the immune response. You know, there's a lot of reasons why those combinations might be appealing.